that aside, I don't think I'm convinced that I want luggage that I need to charge, first of all. I have to charge enough things. That's right out. Listeners, and welcome to episode 61 of Bad Voltage.
Yeah.
Now, the first thing you might notice about this intro is that Brian Lunduk, our distinguished colleague Brian Lunduk, is not here. He's just not here for the intro and outro. He is here for all the rest of the segments. And speaking of those segments, what are we going to be talking about today, guys?
Well, the first thing is about KDE Neon, which is a new... possibly distribution, possibly technology showcase. No one's really very sure what it is, and that's the point from the KDE project. We look at what it is, why it came about.
We're also going to be doing I'm going to be doing a review of the Blue Smart Suitcase, which is a suitcase from the future. And if you are the CEO of Blue Smart, you should probably switch off listening right now.
I was going to say, and what a bleak future that would be. And a few episodes ago, we had a kind of a discussion about the Software Freedom Conservancy and some things around that, and Bradley Kuhn actually emailed us some feedback after that, and as a result of that, we're going to have Bradley Kuhn and Karen Sandler from the SFC on in the show.
And then we're also going to check in with Rachel Romeliotis, who is the strategic content director at O'Reilly for the OSCON conference. We talked about OSCON briefly in the last show as part of a segment on conferences, and we thought, well, let's check in with Rachel and see what she's got to say about the event.
And now, Bad Voltage.
A couple of weeks back at BOSDEM, which is a conference I've never actually been to and would really like to get there one of these days, the KDE team, or specifically a subset of the KDE team, announced a project called KDE Neon. Now, KDE Neon is a code name that's been around for a couple of years, and the basic idea behind it from a few years back was to provide, as I understand it, up-to-date packages of KDE pulled from GitHub, so kind of latest developer builds available for people who are working on it to test. Very straightforward, very reasonable. Now, an aside, Kubuntu. As we all probably remember, there was a lot of brouhaha over the last year or so around Kubuntu, specifically around Jonathan Riddell saying some things, Canonical getting mad, back and forth, lots of yelling and moaning and screaming, and eventually Jonathan Riddell, the founder of Kubuntu and the main guy behind it, ended up leaving the Kubuntu project. We'll kind of leave that one. You can go Google it and find out more details.
Yeah. Leaving / booted out.
Yeah. A subtle combination of the two, really. So Jonathan Riddell starts this new project called KDE Neon, which is Kubuntu. They took Kubuntu and are basically rebooting it as KDE Neon as an official KDE incubator project. Now, when they announced this, they also had a series of emails on various mailing lists from the KDE board saying that it was great that KDE could now have its own Linux distribution. So, KDE Neon, a distribution, really the only distribution under the KDE project, is now based on Ubuntu. And in the frequently asked questions for the KDE Neon website, it stated that the team did so, chose Ubuntu, because Ubuntu was the best technology. Clearly, since people don't usually go to Ubuntu to run the KDE Plasma desktop, they go to run Unity usually, and they go to other distributions to run KDE. This rightly, perhaps, ruffled an awful lot of feathers on people who used or worked on other distributions where KDE was a prominent desktop environment. So I wrote an article about it after a whole bunch of people got upset and kind of emailed me about it or messaged me about it, or I saw other people kind of bitching and moaning on mailing lists and forums and whatnot. So I wrote an article about it basically stating that I thought it was a really, really terrible idea. At which point the KDE community completely exploded. weird. And I want to get to you guys' thoughts on this in a moment, but I want to make sure you guys have all of the updates. So they exploded. And so what I did is I went over to the KDE promotional mailing list, offered some help, because it seemed like perhaps they hadn't really communicated their intentions yet, right? So I got a lot of mixed communications. Some people said it was the KDE distro. Other people said it was just a KDE distro, and there could really theoretically be thousands of them. Other people still said it's not even a Linux distribution at all. It's something else entirely that we're not going to explain to you. There was a lot of mixed understandings within the KDE community itself about what this really was. So I said, you know what? This seems to be a communication problem. I'll offer my help. So I offered my help. I'll help get the word out there, and a couple of people from KDE took me up on that. A couple of people aboard talked with me, and eventually what it came to is they still really don't know as a community exactly what this is, except Jonathan Riddell and the folks behind KDE Neon, which is a very small subset of the KDE community. I'm very small, I should point out.
Right.
They are very clear that it is based on Ubuntu, Kubuntu specifically, and it is a Linux distribution, but it's not a Linux distribution. So I had to write a follow-up article to this, and this is where I'm going to stop and pass it over to you guys. During that article, I got a lot of great feedback from the KDE board, from the maintainers of KDE Plasma, that made things a lot clearer. And I thought, okay, this is great. I'll post their responses up in this article. And so I reached out to Jonathan Riddell as well. He's the main man behind KDE Neon. I'm like, hey man, let's do an interview, or you can just make a statement, and I'll just copy and paste it, and I won't edit it at all, and you can just make your statement to the world about what this is, what it's not, and kind of put any concerns to rest. His entire response, and I'm going to read it verbatim, "Awa and boil your hide, ye twonkle." That was his entire response to me as I was offering him.
That might be
him
the most Scottish thing I've ever heard.
That is so Scottish.
I don't know what it means.
I suspect the word is heed. But yeah, other than
heed.
That, yes.
Yes. So basically, I put it into Google Translate a couple of times, and it basically says, go away and boil your head. Yes. You twinkle, because apparently the translation from Scottish twonkle to English is twinkle, which didn't really help me a whole lot, except I think he meant that in a derogatory way. I don't think it was meant in the I love how twinkly you are way. But anyway, so this has been happening. So what I'm curious from your guys' point of view, should a big project like a KDE or a GNOME have their own specific Linux distribution? The one, the main, whether it's however it's meant, whether it's main for, you know, showcasing the latest and greatest, or being the end all be all, whatever it's for, should it have its own Linux distribution?
I don't know if it's because you're coming from an OpenSUSE perspective, and I'm curious how Jono and Eck, coming from an Ubuntu perspective, maybe that colors what they think. Coming from neither perspective, I did not interpret it the way you did. Although having to search for your article, the title, for listeners who haven't read it, is KDE's new distro, terrible idea or simply a huge mistake?
Now, wait a minute. Now, a lot of people, I gotta point this out. A lot of people kind of accused me of having basically kind of a flame-baity, click-baity title for this.
Really?
Now, here's the thing. At the time that I wrote the article, everything in it was accurate based on the information KDE provided, and I legitimately could not figure out whether it was a terrible idea or a huge mistake. I was trying to figure out which it was.
So I know they clarified the FAQ since the first article, but there is it a distro? The answer is not quite. It's a package archive with the latest KDE software on top of a stable base. While we plan to have installable images, unlike full Linux distributions, we're only interested in KDE software. That roughly is how I interpreted the initial announcement.
It seems to me that what they're doing is they've got this archive of KDE software that they're going to keep up to date that will run on Ubuntu. And they also happen to provide a downloadable ISO that you can burn to a disk.
Right. It just happens to look, smell, feel, and generally seem like a distro.
So when you boot it up, will it say KDE Neon or will it say Ubuntu, but then load the latest KDE?
I mean, I have no idea. Right now, I think it just says Kubuntu.
But it seems to me that what they're doing, that there's some things here which I think are somewhat clear. Like the idea that they have this, what I would mentally think of as something similar to a PPA, like an archive of software that they build that's up to date. And then they ship it on a distribution base, and they've used Ubuntu, you know, whatever, and they only ship KDE software, and other distros do ship a multitude of other stuff as well, mainly because KDE doesn't cover all bases right now.
Right.
I get that, right? And that, to me, seems like it makes sense. Where I'm unclear on this, there's a few reasons why this seems a bit odd to me. One is, I don't understand why they picked Ubuntu. Much as I love Ubuntu, there has been a somewhat tumultuous relationship between Jonathan Rudol and Canonical and the Ubuntu community. I'm surprised that they didn't want to go somewhere else. Although I also respect the fact that despite that tumultuous relationship, they're making really pragmatic decisions and they've decided to use something that they know. That seems fine to me. The second thing is, I want to know where Blue Systems fits into this. Blue Systems are the company that hires Jonathan and a bunch of other KDE people. That's bankrolled by some rich German guy called Clemens something. I can't remember his name. And it's entirely unclear what this company is doing. And they have things like Netrunner, and they do a bunch of work on Plasma.
Yep.
And this seems to be at least partially funded by Blue Systems because Jonathan and some of these other people are working on it. So I'm curious to see. There's this very ambiguous involvement of this company, which I'm not necessarily suggesting is a bad thing. Maybe it's just some rich dude who wants to pay some KDE developers to create KDE and doesn't want to make a business model out of it. I'd like to know what that involvement is. But overall, to me, like, this seems cool. You know, they're making it. There's always been this issue of upstream building software and then downstream packaging it. And there's always been a natural tension between the two in that upstream are often not very happy with the way it's being packaged and delivered, and the fact that they're doing this with Neon, I think, is a nice way of bridging.
Well, here's one of the problems I think that a lot of people are having with it. When the GNOME team started talking about dependencies on systemd, people got upset, right? People got upset, and understandably upset, because they're reaching outside of the desktop environment into other system components that they now have a dependency on, which would in theory create an issue where they only run on certain distributions. That is a potential problem. When you have a desktop environment focused project and they create their own distribution, the way they worded it, there was a statement in there along the lines of allowing them to test out new things and allowing them to try things quicker because they have a distribution. They can make changes outside of the desktop environment to be used within the desktop environment, which means that it suggests anyway the possibility that going forward, there's going to be an increasing amount of dependencies outside of Plasma on either this KDE Neon project or Ubuntu itself, etc., and making it harder to work on other distributions. I think that's where the primary concern comes from. Now, clearly, there was a statement from the KDE Plasma maintainer that basically said, you know what, we're going to stay agnostic, we're still going to work on other distros, and I think that's great. That's the right way to go, and that's a good message for them to put out, but it's a muddied message because there's so many conflicting statements coming out of the KDE team as a whole. So it's hard to know how this is going to go.
If they would have based this on Tumbleweed, you would have written that identical article.
It's the same problem. So now here's the flip side to this. Since this happened, and I should point out that KDE Neon is not yet available for download. They basically pre-announced it, right? They basically pre-announced it and point to an ISO of Kubuntu and say it will be something more later. Now, and since it's come out, the OpenSUSE project has come along and said, okay, we'll do exactly what your goals are, have daily builds pulled directly from Git of all the latest KDE stuff, and here's ISOs that are updated daily from the KDE project. We called it, I think it was Argon and Krypton. Since they went with Neon, we went for a different noble gas. And that's fine coming from a distro project. Like if Ubuntu want to do something similar, it's cool. If Fedora wants to have a respin that's focused on latest and greatest KDE pulled straight from Git, awesome. The project themselves of the actual desktop environments, probably shouldn't be doing that. Gnome shouldn't do that either. Gnome shouldn't come along and say, we have Gnome OS now. Now, I know Gnome OS is an actual project name, but there is no actual Linux distro called Gnome OS. But no, if there were, that would be an issue. That would be a potential problem. And I think, rightly so, a lot of people would say, hey, I think there's a conflict of interest here. The, if a company makes a distro and then makes their own desktop environment to go with it, like what Ubuntu did, I really don't have an issue with that per se. That's not a problem. It's distros that are desktop environments that are supposed to be agnostic to the platform and can move around all over the place having their own platform.
But it creates a conflict of interest. Doing, for it God's is what sake. Doing, it's a technology demonstration, a platform in which they can say, right, we control this top to bottom. Look at SUSE Studio, right? SUSE Studio is full of what, there are 11,000 different appliances.
Yeah.
Which are basically, you know, someone has gone, okay, this is going to be a demonstration for Cinnamon. This is going to be a demonstration for my particular bit of software, which is totally configured correctly. I mean, essentially, totally fine with that. this idea of building the ultimate image to demonstrate your piece of software is what Docker is for, right? Every Docker image is that for a downloadable piece of software. And that's just what KDE Neon is. I think the reason they're going, is it a distro or isn't it? Obviously, it is a distribution in the same way that everything in SUSE Studio is a distribution. Yeah. But they're not expecting people to go, I'm going to stop using Kubuntu or SUSE, and I'm going to switch to one of these. It's more like a Docker image than
I think it's honorable that the Neon distribution. I think it's honorable that the Neon team want to make that distinction, because the KDE project,
I poked them in the eye with a sharp rod and then sat on a mailing list and worked with them on it for a long time, they eventually added a few words to try and make that distinction. Because originally, it was not, they were very clear, this is the KDE distribution, it's a Linux distribution, it's where we can do testing for new stuff going forward.
I never saw the KDE distribution.
No, when that was pre-announced on G+,
they said, no, the exact phrase was, at last, KDE can have a Linux distribution. Something like, it was a phrase like that.
I completely agree with what the GNOME team did and what KDE want to be able to have the freedom to do, which is say, can we make KDE better by sharpening up our understanding of the whole stack? You know, rather than saying, well, we're only allowed to fiddle with the stuff at the level of KDE Plasma.
But the reason GNOME
depended on systemd is precisely because they can then say, here is an interface we can depend on.
I don't disagree with you on that. I think that decision was so contentious
because systemd itself is so contentious. So you're kind of cherry-picking an example there.
No, that is true. You're totally right. It is a cherry-picked example. But the only way that it becomes valuable is if you are saying, okay, the system that we're sitting on top of, we're standardizing on, and then we can work on those components, which means that you are saying systems that do not adhere to those non-desktop environment components are no longer supported. And so what you're saying is we're going to focus on Ubuntu, and not just Ubuntu, our iteration of Ubuntu as the future of this desktop environment platform, which I'm okay with. But I feel like those things need to be said if that's the intention. And some of the things that are said suggest that's the intention. And some of the things suggest that it's not even a distro at all. And some things suggest it's the future of KDE. And other things suggest it's just something for a couple of people to toy around with on a weekend.
So your issue is not particularly whether KDE Neon exists or what it is. It's that it's confused messaging.
It is very confused messaging.
They can pick one
messaging.
Of them and be fine about it, I and then you're like, think, okay.
Yes, I think that really is it. If they came out and said, this is the KDE distribution of the future, well, then I can be like, well, here's the middle finger to KDE, and I guess no one's going to use it anymore. It's done. But I don't think that's what the KDE Plasma team wants. That's more, it seems like some of the messaging, some, not all, of the messaging coming from the Neon team. And the Neon team, it was quickly pointed out to me, has nothing to do with the Plasma team. And there's no central mechanism within the KDE project where those groups of people work together and actually come up with common messaging or anything like that. I tried to talk with them, and it's very anarchistic, and that's both beautiful and difficult.
I think it's important to you touched on that, Brian, like the context of what KD as a project is. KD for many, many years, in fact, pretty much since Mateus Atrik moved on,
yeah,
has been pretty much a leaderless project. Like it's been more of a like a world in which anybody can do
and
anything.
Cool. That is cool.
And that's awesome. Yeah. And that's and it's the one of the very few open source communities that operates that way and does it very well.
Yeah.
That's why I'd be very surprised if they ever came out and said,
no,
this is the main thing. I think what's actually happened here, two things I'm guessing. One is that the Neon team are, they're engineers and they're not experts on messaging.
Right.
And number two is classic Brian Lundick reading way too much into a situation.
And that may be. That very well, but see, here's the thing. It's not just me that read that.
I believe there is a grain of truth in each of those statements.
It's not me that read into that. The number of people that contacted me from other projects, from boards of other projects, having the exact same concerns, it was fairly large. And a lot of that can be assuaged by better communication happening from the KDE project, and they know that they know they suck at it. I sat on a conference call like a weekend ago with some members of the board, and they were like nodding along, like yeah, we know we need to improve here. And they get that, but it does create a problem. We are in a position right now where what exactly this project is, Neon is still a bit unclear, despite multiple attempts by the team itself and other people to clarify it, and some of the ways it could be interpreted could be potentially very damaging to KDE Plasma's relationship with other distros. Other ways are not a problem at all. It's just continued to be very muddy.
Well, here is the thing, right? There is obviously part of the reason there's all this confusion is that there is no agreement inside KDE as a whole whether doing this kind of thing is a good idea. The fact that KDE now Neon now exists, which has obviously come from
a part of the KDE project
who think it is a good idea.
Now, right? They did have a vote to say that they would they can make this an official KDE incubator project, yeah, and that could have the KDE name and whatnot. They held an official membership vote for
this, this discussion, the fact that they're having this discussion at all, will help them decide as a project whether they want an official KDE showcase or whether their raison d'etre is to exist everywhere else and to be packaged by other places and how to do that. And having that clarity can only be a good thing, even though in the interregnum, everything's all over the bloody place.
Even though it's a complete mess in the meantime.
I would love to see if we can get Riddle on the show to, first of all, explain what on earth that email was to Brian. Hopefully it was deeply insulting.
Well, he told me that I am a twinkle, which I'm just going to take it as a delightful thing.
You are definitely a twinkle. You could definitely perceive that in two very different ways.
Wait, no.
You're my twinkle.
To my British-y friends here, what is a twonkle? Do you guys know what a twonkle is?
No, that's not a word. That's not a word. That's a Scottish word.
Also, no, no, why would you is. Boil is boil your head a common phrase?
That's a Scots. No, that's a Scots
that's
thing.
Definitely Scottish. Maybe Neuro can translate for us.
People who know what that means, if they want to help us out on community.org.
It means that back in the day, making your head into food would have been one of the most degrading things you could have done to someone.
Is that what it means?
That's the genesis of the term, yes.
Making your head into food.
Boiler head, that just kind of means go away in stronger terms. Yeah.
This is why, the reason Jeremy knows about this is that it's now sous vide your head, obviously.
Nice.
Like many of you, I have to travel quite a bit with my day job. With all the travel over the years, I've got my travel prep down to something of a science. I carry spare battery packs, multiple cables, sundry medicines, portable stashes of vitamins and health supplements, and I have my check-in and travel routine down. I thought I was leading the charge in travel preparedness until my father-in-law gave Eric and I a special gift, the Blue Smart suitcase. In a nutshell, this is a revved-up suitcase. It includes a built-in battery and charging ports, GPS location tracking, distance alerts if you leave your suitcase behind, a digital lock, and a built-in scale. The suitcase itself is fairly small and would be mainly useful for shorter trips. It works well for me as I never, ever, ever, ever check a bag, and it serves well as a carry-on. It's got wheels that move in any direction, a laptop compartment, internal zip section, and a decent amount of room. Now, it's not quite as roomy as a similar size suitcase though, because it packs in the electronics that deliver its features.
It does, though, feel really high quality. It's sturdy, the wheels are strong, and it feels like a higher-end Samsonite-type case. I can definitely see this standing up to the rigors of the road. The case, though, is the least interesting bit, though. What about the gadgets? For a start, the built-in battery is nice enough. It has a USB port included, and you simply plug the case in to charge up the battery and then plug your devices into the case. While handy, this isn't particularly useful with the many portable battery packs most of us seem to have, either by buying them or more commonly getting them as freebies at conferences. For the more exciting features, you install the BlueSmart app on your phone. Setup was simple, I switched on the suitcase and the app detected and connected to it, and from there you have some simple options on the screen. The digital lock works as expected, I can tap the icon on my phone and it'll lock the case. The GPS tracking also worked well. Built into the BlueSmart is a 3G card that works globally, and it reported the location with a great level of accuracy back to my phone. I was excited about the built-in scale, but unfortunately I had some issues with the connection to the suitcase and didn't have a chance to figure out those issues to test the scale properly. It got stuck on the calibrating screen and then struggled to connect, but I'm sure that this is just a temporary blip. To be honest, when I went into this review, I was pretty cynical. This whole thing felt like a fairly redundant piece of technology with all the other devices that we have and carry with us. But while the usefulness of the BlueSmart could be questioned, the execution of the product is really rather good. So, what is the bad voltage verdict? While the BlueSmart case may not be a critical requirement for every traveler, it does pack in some handy features into an overall high-quality product. At $400, it isn't cheap, but if you want the future of suitcases, this is a pretty decent product to explore.
The future of suitcases?
That I never thought I'd ever say that.
Ridiculous phrase I have ever heard in my life.
So many comments. First of all, for those of you who don't actually know John O and, or have traveled with him in the past, he does legitimately carry more supplements and vitamins than anyone I have ever met in my life. He almost needs a separate carry-on just for that stuff. But that aside, I don't think I'm convinced that I want luggage that I need to charge, first of all. I have to charge enough things. That's right out. And I think everyone I know, like you said, already has a charger and already has one that's better because it's a quick charger or whatever the iteration of it you have is, that you don't need one in your luggage.
One of the conceptually nice things about this is it could have a huge battery in it.
But yet it doesn't.
But yet it doesn't.
It has so, half the it has half
yeah, it
the capacity
sucks,
of
but the
this.
Concept is good.
So no. And no, then since it is a carry-on bag, right, a carry-on is always at your side by definition. So why you would need GPS to say, yep, still next to me, seems asinine. And I've flown almost every airline in different countries, value ones, legacy ones. I've never had anyone weigh a carry-on. They right. only weigh check bags. So
well, to be
all
fair,
the features
I mean,
are useless.
To be fair, within a carry-on setting, I agree that the features are frankly
But it is
irrelevant.
A carry-on. And the odd thing about it being a carry-on,
of what this is, it's terrible,
no, well,
is what you're saying.
If you were to use this, I can understand if you were to use this, if you were, so for example, you know, some women check bags because they're carrying, like, liquids, right? And they'll check a bag because, you know, men generally carry fewer liquids. I can understand if you're going on a shorter trip and you check this bag, the features are more relevant, but yeah, it's really kind of designed as a carry-on from what I can see.
It is a carry-on, but the carry-on, at least in the US, size is 22 by 14 by 9. This is 22.4 by 14.4 by 9.8, so it won't actually fit in a carry-on luggage. If they do make you rack it, and one of the most popular luggage review sites pointed that out, and the CEO and the president of the company screamed at him via email and then just changed the website to lie about the size of the bag.
Now, I was going to get on to that, but before we get on to that point, right, this bag has to be a carry-on because you're not allowed to check bags with batteries in them.
Right.
If you get on an airplane now, they will say you can't take more than X amount of batteries for all your electronic equipment. You have to take the bag you cannot take the battery out of. It has to be a carry-on bag, and it's too big to be a carry-on bag. And if you tell anyone that, they have a massive go at you.
I think
we should enlarge upon this.
I think I read somewhere, though, that this particular bag is TSA approved. This may have been before the... I know the battery thing you were going on about when you were over here for scale is a relatively recent thing.
It is.
I seem to remember that this is TSA approved for that, but that may have happened after they became
TSA
approved.
Well, the battery is small enough that I'm sure that it doesn't go over the limit for the batteries. I wouldn't think.
Yeah, so but you've got to be careful about that. They have talked about banning batteries entirely in cargo baggage.
So, okay. Logistics about whether you can actually bring it onto the plane aside, ignoring the fact that the connection between the phone and the suitcase doesn't always work. So that kind of leaves you a little concerned about whether or not you can unlock it or lock it. Let's ignore that for a minute. Let's ignore the fact that the weight thing is the most pointless feature I can possibly think of. Let's also ignore the fact
that's cool.
I've got several more
ignores here. Stupid.
Hold
the
on.
Weight thing's cool.
The weight thing would be cool if it was checked luggage.
Yes.
Well, and also, the weight thing would be cool if it was big enough to make it go over the weight capacity for it.
Unless you're hugging this thing with bricks.
Throw some copper bars in it or something like that. So here's the thing that I come up against. It's a little bit smaller in terms of what you can put in it because of all the crap it has, right? It has a little bit less space. But luckily... once you get to a conference and you need that little portable battery charger with you, all you have to do is bring your entire suitcase with you throughout the conference, wherever you go. How convenient is that? That just makes up for all of the problems that this has for being a terrible suitcase.
I think it's mainly designed that people plug their devices into it when they go to bed at night. But I get your point. You know, it's...
when they go to bed
in case you're in a hotel that doesn't have...
Any outlets. Right. Just to clarify, Jono, this is the case that I borrowed from you and took to scale, right?
It is that.
Oh, you've used that tech?
Now, first of all, I've actually used this case. And when Jono says it's a little bit smaller inside than other cases it took because of all the electronics, he is materially understating the truth, right? this case, it's not so much like, you know, you've got a case with a little bit less room inside. It's like buying a peach but only wanting the stone, the little tiny bit in the middle. Right? It's like an oyster inside a pearl. There is no room in this stupid case.
But it's basically, from what I can tell, this is basically the Gary Busey of suitcases.
Well,
it's conceivably useful, but it's
I have to say, we have to not pass over this whole thing with the CEO, right? We were sitting on BART reading reviews of this suitcase. And Jeremy's obviously come across exactly the same thing. A website reviewed the case, and the CEO showed up in the comments hurling abuse at them for giving a negative review.
The review wasn't that negative. It wasn't half as negative as this segment is turning out to be.
I'm looking forward to getting in touch with us. It was like reading, when you read these cases, no pun intended, a review getting a product getting a bad review, and then the people behind the product, like, basically go after the journalist, go after the people because they didn't, for whatever reason, they felt the review was unfair. Look, sometimes unfair things happen and are said in publications, whatever else. But for the CEO to go after them was really disappointing.
Right.
So hopefully this won't happen with us. But we'll see.
Perhaps the CEO should have read John O'Bacon's book, Dealing with Disrespect. That might have helped him to understand how to properly respond.
I like how many plugs I'm getting.
In a contrary thing to all Jono's plugs for everything, I would like to take issue with the bad voltage verdict and say, at $400, it isn't cheap, but if you want the future of suitcases, look elsewhere. But
I don't even know what the future of suitcases is.
You could, to be fair, buy a regular suitcase.
And then a battery charger and throw it in.
Like, just
gaffer tape a battery on the inside.
Well, let's be clear. You could buy a regular suitcase and a battery charger and then 15 more regular suitcases for $400. I mean,
I'm not sure where you buy your suitcase.
Yeah, that's a really cheap suitcase. Anyway, I think we can wrap this up safely by saying it's amazing.
I'm going to buy one now.
Okay, so on the show now, we've got Karen Sandler and Bradley Kuhn from the Software Freedom Conservancy. Karen serves as executive director, and Bradley is distinguished technologist and president at the organization. Welcome, Karen and Bradley. How are you doing?
We're great.
Great. Thanks for bringing us on the show.
Awesome. So let's get started right at the beginning. Some people won't know of what Conservancy is and the work that you do. Can you just give us, maybe Bradley, you can start with, like, maybe can you just give us an overview of what the organization is and what you focus on?
So our primary job is to provide a not-for-profit charity home for open source and free software projects, and basically take on all the tasks that developers either aren't very good at or don't like doing, but are absolutely necessary for projects. So we handle all sorts of different things for them, everything from the most mundane, such as bookkeeping and handling their donations and making sure they have money to pay contractors if they can raise money for that, all the way up to handling licensing questions and also handling their enforcement of their licenses if they need that.
And can you give us an example of some projects that, I mean, I saw recently, I think it was yesterday, that Homebrew, which is the, you know, the packaging repository of applications for Mac OS X, it's not just Linux focused, but can you maybe share some other projects that are covered under the work that you're doing?
Yeah, we have over 30 projects, and that includes Inkscape, Samba, Wine, QEMU. We also have Outreachy, which is the diversity program that provides paid internships to women and people of color from underrepresented groups in U.S. tech. And we have the GPL compliance project for kernel developers and the Debian aggregation, Debian copyright aggregation project.
And a few others, Karen. Gotcha. There's also BuildBot and Boost, the Bro Network Security Monitoring, Evergreen, which is a library services system, Calathea, which is a GitHub-like system that you can run on your own site, a couple of
Sugar Labs
networks. Yeah, we have over 30, so we could list them all if you want.
Evergreen.
Or we could list the ones your listeners are most interested in.
So it sounds like there's a lot going on, which is good. One thing I wanted to ask about, just to kick things off, is, and then I'll certainly let my distinguished co-hosts weigh in, is GPL compliance. We see a lot about this, you know, that this is, you know, shown up in particularly the open source, the Linux, the free software press. What is so important about GPL compliance, and what is the work that you do on this?
GPL compliance is really important because so the license terms that are incorporated into the GPL protect the sharing of source code under the Four Freedoms, and it's copyleft, which means that the software is forever free. Your listeners are pretty savvy, so I'm probably not going to go into a whole intro to copyleft in the GPL.
Probably safe,
but
right.
In order, what'd you say?
It's probably safe.
Yeah, but in order to be sure that, or in order to encourage people to follow these terms, there needs to be so there are different aspects of promoting GPL compliance and following the terms of the license, and that involves publishing information about how to comply with the licenses, which we do in partnership with the FSF in copyleft.org. And then there's also enforcing the licenses, which we do on behalf of several of our projects. And enforcing the licenses entails contacting companies and others when they're out of compliance of the licenses. So they're not following the license terms. They're distributing products that don't have the source code or offer for source with them. Or if they do, the source code that they're distributing is not fully in compliance with the license. And we help them understand what the license entails. And then we help working with them. The reason why this is so important is that if there isn't anyone out there who is compelling compliance under these licenses, we may as well not have these license requirements at all. Because what happens is when nobody asks for compliance with these terms, then eventually nobody follows them.
Right. Yeah, the point I would add to that by pointing out that all free software communities ask for companies to give their changes back. So if you consider something like Apache, of course, in the Apache community, they always say, well, don't make a proprietary fork. Give us patches upstream. The GPL goes one step further. It asks first, and then if people say, no, we're not going to do that, there's a legal mechanism to compel them to do that and require them to do that. So if you're only asking nicely and never going further to say, well, if you don't do it, there is a consequence, there's really no visible difference between the two types of licensing.
Gotcha. So do you guys, how often does it really come up that you need to really get into the legal mechanisms and actually enforce this?
More than ever and all the time. I'm fond of saying that I'm usually aware of hundreds of GPL violations that are ongoing where companies have been asked to give the source code and have just ignored the requester or something else like that. There's probably thousands out there at any given time, products on the market, usually the majority being in the embedded Linux device space. The Internet of Things are often violating the GPL. And it's gotten worse over time, not better, unfortunately.
So, but I mean, how from this conservancy point of view specifically, like how often do you guys get involved at it from that angle of really pushing the legal avenue?
So it very quickly gets to pushing the legal avenue, and then actually we often back off. So like in order to get many companies to listen to the requests for compliance with the GPL, you have to escalate to some degree. So often we wind up having to make contact with, so we try to make friendly contact as best as possible, but oftentimes that just simply isn't effective with companies. So quite often we have to make legal overtures quite early in order to get the appropriate attention within the company. But then once we have the right attention within the company, we try to get engineering involved and sort of explain this whole process and that we're seeking compliance. We recently published some principles along with the FSF for community-driven copyleft enforcement. And that kind of sets forth the ways in which we conduct this compliance and that we really want to work with these companies to come into compliance. But I have to say, if you didn't have the ability to say that you're in big legal trouble if you don't follow these rules, then we probably would often not get past stage one.
Right. Now, while I appreciate the fact that obviously there is that option of escalating to, you know, possibly suing people or some kind of legal thing, it doesn't seem to be having that much of an actual deterrent effect. I mean, in general, I would say that if you get an Android or embedded Linux device from a company that you've never heard of, it will violate the GPL. Basically all the time. And now I appreciate this is not the Conservancy's job to fix this. We're all sitting back going, come on, Conservancy, fix this, right? It's important. But
we work a lot of hours to try to fix it, Stuart. We take that seriously. It's a reasonable request. Hey, fix it. We hear you.
Yeah, but what we've seen this ground game. I mean, you know, you started off, you're using BusyBox as a tool to kind of change these people, and then there's been other threats of legal escalation and so on, but it isn't fixing anything, is it? I mean, maybe you'll tell me that I'm wrong, and actually it's having a big effect, but exactly as you said earlier, Bradley,
can I just add kind of a follow-up that I think you can answer at the same time, is that do you think it also has contributed to the GPL going from by far the number one license to now two and going to be number three pretty soon after Apache and MIT, I think, has surpassed it as number one. Do you think this compliance stuff, A, is, as Stuart said, is it making a difference? And B, do you think that's contributed to the GPL being used a little less often now? Or do you think there's other reasons behind that?
Well, I think
those
are
big questions.
Yeah.
Sorry, there was a lot in there.
There is a lot in there.
First of all, let's take the second one first. John Sullivan of the FSF gave a great talk a couple years ago at FOSDEM about the point that all these people who say the GPL is in decline, et cetera, and so on, there's actually no really good data either way to know for sure. There's lots of ways you can measure it. And if you measure it one way, there's more GPL software. And you measure it another way, there's more non-copylefted software. So I think we don't actually know the numbers, in part because there's nobody, when we write free software, that you have to report to about, I've written some free software and released it. The part that I realize that's somewhat of a disingenuous answer to that question. The part that we definitely see is a pressure by companies to encourage employees to contribute to non-copylefted projects, and even companies favoring non-copyleft alternatives. A great example is LLVM versus GCC. You see large companies like Apple and Qualcomm, who dislike the GPL, heavily funding LLVM, in part because they don't want to have a GPL compiler anymore. So that phenomenon is there. I don't think it actually relates to enforcement. It relates to the fact that the license is a copyleft license, and they don't ever want to have the possibility that it's enforced. The first GPL enforcement action was all the way back with, in fact, Steve Jobs himself, when he was at Next, when they tried to make Objective-C proprietary for GCC and the FSF enforced. So it's been long known since the late 80s that enforcement would happen if you tried to make proprietary additions to GPL. That's just been the fact. Whether people are saying, well, we don't want that to ever happen, so we're only going to do permissively licensed and non-copylefted projects, that's certainly happening with for-profit companies. I see actually individual developers more excited than ever, particularly in the Linux community, about strong copyleft and about the GPL. So I think that's most of the answer to the second question. The first question, do you want to take the first question, Karen?
Can I? Well, I was actually going to weigh in on the second question first, which is to say that I think that also what has happened is that, you know, when, you know, in early days of the GPL, companies were often saying that they would never use any software that was under the GPL V2. And they would say, they said, it's, you know, this is impossible, and it's viral, and there was a lot of scare tactics. But companies started to use GPL code because it was so useful. And so they found a way to get comfortable with it because they needed it. And then what happened was somehow the messaging got out much more effectively to developers that if they want adoption of their software quickly, that they should go with a permissive license. And I think that's actually gained a lot more traction than many of the scare tactics early on. And so developers were for a period of time convinced that what difference did it really matter if, as long as my software is out there and it's being developed and we have a strong ecosystem around it. And I think that what people have been finding is that the lax permissive licenses don't necessarily accomplish the same things. And so I agree with Bradley that we're seeing a lot more excitement about the GPL and copyleft now, a really exciting resurgence.
And so we should answer Stuart's question. You probably have more questions, but we never even answered Stuart's question, which is why aren't we solving the violations that are out there? And I think the complexity with that is that the violators are more savvy. So we have a pretty easy process. It's time-consuming but straightforward to handle, you know, the fly-by-night Android distributor who violates. And we've done lots of enforcement actions like that. One of the things we've found is that because it's a lot of effort to deal with, it means that if they're a fly-by-night operation, by the time you get into the compliance, they go out of business. And we've done cases like that we've dealt with. What we're trying to do now really is to establish the proper case law, effectively, with regard to copyright and combined and derivative works, which is the center of what makes strong copyleft function. This is why we're funding the VMware lawsuit in Germany that Christoph Hellwig is currently litigating there against VMware, because it asked that very question. VMware took parts of Linux and adapted it to their proprietary kernel and is only distributing some, not all, of the source code as required by GPL and by copyright law. So we're going to chase that, and then we're going to have to probably bring more cases over time against what I call the savvy violators. These are the real dangerous ones. These are the ones who understand there's an obligation under GPL, and they're trying to circumvent it. They're trying to make the GPL more like a weak copyleft. You'll see a lot of companies that kind of treat the GPL on Linux like it's the LGPL. Well, we can make a bunch of proprietary add-ons, that's allowed. Well, that is allowed with lesser GPL software, but not pure GPL software. And those are the cases that we're going to have to bring. And I think over the long period that it takes to bring court cases, I mean, many times it takes 5 to 10 years to adjudicate a case from start to finish. As we start to do that more, we'll see more compliance. Certainly when we brought BusyBox lawsuits regularly, which we used to do back in the late 2000s, I guess, we saw compliance getting better. And compliance did get better briefly, but there kind of has to always be some litigation and some enforcement going on to keep people in line effectively.
Yeah, I think that that touches on the other question of, is enforcement making it worse, or are you completely wrong? And I was saying you're completely wrong, because what you don't see from this is the inside risk analysis that happens at you know, with the lawyers inside companies with management, where management says, what really is the risk if we wind up violating in these ways? And if there are no lawsuits, the counsel really has nothing to say. They can't say that there's, you know, they say there's this theoretical risk. If there are actual lawsuits, then there's a reason for management to really take that into account. And I found a lot of in-house counsel secretly, or, you know, privately thanking me for continuing to do this work, because it means that they have a voice and that they can actually compel their company to do the right thing.
That makes sense.
Quick, silly question, I guess you could say. Using the example of VMware, and we could spend a lot of time getting into VMware, which we obviously don't have that kind of time, and people can go and read up about it on the Conservancy website. But is not a major issue here with the fact that Conservancy is a small member-driven, member-funded organization, you know, from individual donors primarily. And VMware is just one example, or include your other favorite company, are enormous companies with massive legal departments and endless amounts of cash. You know, how are you, how is Conservancy able to even just get into the game here, just in terms of the costs of litigating?
Well, I think that there's a real advantage, first of all, to being the underdog in a court case, because one of the arguments you can make, and people can read this if they go read the old BusyBox lawsuits, the fortunate thing about court cases in the U.S. is that they're entirely public. And the unfortunate thing about cases in the U.S. is that they're entirely public, which means they end up taking longer. In Germany, it's much different. It's all private. But fortunately, the U.S. ones are public, and people can go read some of the filings and discussions with the judge that happened in those BusyBox suits. And what you find is that there's a real tendency for the courts to look at, in those cases, it was Software Freedom Conservancy and Eric Anderson versus a company. And when they look at a small charity plus an individual developer filing a lawsuit against, you know, Big Corp, that looks much more favorable. And if it does ever go to a jury, juries tend to look much more favorably on small plaintiffs who are being wronged, which I think in this case is perfectly true. So I'm not so worried about that. Now, there is the resource question, which is they can bury you in paper and so forth, which is tough. And that's why we're running a fundraising campaign, and we hope people will go and contribute to sfconservancy.org/supporter and become a supporter to help us do this. People have asked, as you kind of are, well, why aren't you funding? Isn't there some other way you could fund this? I've spent basically 20 years of my career at this point, little under 20 years of my career doing GPL enforcement. In some capacity or other. And I've looked at every different way to fund it. And frankly, the only ways you can get large amounts of money are very quick to evaporate, and they have a corruption aspect to them. So one of the things that happens is lots of companies now do, MySQL was the first to make this business model popular, is they basically sell a proprietary license to people who don't want to follow the GPL. And you can make a lot of money that way. The problem is that you're basically just producing more proprietary software in the world by using the GPL, ironically. Because most people who want to do something interesting with one of those code bases, MySQL or whatever, they buy a proprietary license and do it in a proprietary way. If your fundamental goal, as ours is to get more software freedom in the world and to use the GPL as the tool it was intended, in the way the tool was intended, to encourage people to release more free software and use a legal mechanism to require it if they refuse, if they've based their work off of yours. Well, the only way to do that is to demand that compliance and make that ahead of any money. And we're always saying to people we negotiate with that compliance is the most important thing. It's more important than a settlement, because all of them ask within minutes of the first conversation, how much do I have to pay you to get out of this? One of our lawyers years ago said something really nice, which was, I like having a client that when I'm out on a boat in the middle of a river and there's tidal waves coming in, that and if a proprietary software company comes in with a helicopter and a big check and says, all you got to do is let us violate the GPL, and we'll save you from all this. We're going to say no. You can't get away with a violation. We're not going to sell you a separate license. You have to comply. And that's the tact we have to take if we're standing up for this as a principle, which we are. The principle is software freedom. The tool is copyleft. We have to use it as intended. So it means that we have to do a lot of scrappy work and work long hours and all these other things as a charity. That's just how it goes.
So I kind of had a question on the model that you guys switched, and you touched on it a little bit because of Jono's question, but I'll ask anyway. It's, you guys were kind of previously funded by a corporate sponsorship model and have very recently changed to the individual donation model. And it looks like you started around November, a little after November 20th, with kind of an initial goal of 750 members as a keep the lights on kind of thing, and then an additional number of members to continue to do compliance work. And it looks like you reached half the goal in a week, which is pretty impressive. And then it took about 2 months to reach the 750 goal. And as of yesterday, it looked like you added another 174. So you're about 448 away from saving compliance work. So what is your opinion on, I know Bradley, you said that you've looked into a bunch of models over the last 20 years, and I'm sure that's probably painfully true on your end, the amount of time that you've put into that. But what is your opinion now that you are doing the individual donor model? Do you think it's sustainable? Has it been tracking along what you expected? Did you think it would go better, worse?
It's been really interesting. We didn't really know what to expect because it was such a dramatic shift to take. I should hesitate to add that we are still a hybrid funding model, and there are companies that that through our recent campaign have actually have resumed funding us or started funding us. But that's we have also, on the other hand, had companies withdraw funding because they didn't like some of the enforcement work that we were doing. And that was simply untenable to be able to continue doing the work. It's been really interesting. And what is great about it is that if we successfully pivot fully to a supporter-funded model, which we're not there yet, as you point out, we still have a ways to go to be able to continue to do enforcement. And the more that we do enforcement, the harder it is to bring in any corporate funding. But so we still have a ways to go. But as we get there, it means that our interests are aligned with the public's interests fully. It means that that when we do this hard work, we first of all know that we're supported because, you know, it's not enough for me and Bradley to think that GPL enforcement is right. We can't be doing it just the two of us because we think that's what should be done. We're a public charity. Conservancy is a 501c3 public charity in the U.S. We need to do what's in the public interest. And so by having individuals become supporters, we then know that individuals support this work, that they find it valuable, and that it's worth doing. So what's really cool about having shifted to the supporter model is that when we do what we know we must do, and when we do what we know is right, we don't have that wincing feeling of thinking, oh, but does this mean that we can't make salary next month because we're doing that work? Right. And now we can sort of say, let's trumpet the fact that we're doing this work and that it's right. Let's get as much information out there as possible. And while we're small and it's very hard to both do the work and talk a lot about the work, it's very worthwhile, and it brings a lot more meaning to what we're doing and probably makes it a lot more effective too.
Yeah, and the other thing I would notice is I actually don't know of, I mean, it must have been done by some other charity, I just don't know about it, but it's rare to make your fundraising target goal a number of supporters rather than a number of dollars. We've actually gotten lots of people who have donated smaller donations who lots of people live in other countries where $120 a year is really expensive. And so they've given smaller amounts. And we've actually had some wealthy people come in and set their, I'm going to set my supporter dues at $10,000 instead of $120, which was really wonderful. Which means we're doing well with the fundraising campaign. But the reason we're still doing the little bar as a number of people, so we need 1,000 more individuals to join, is because we want a mandate. We want to have the ability to say there are at least 2,500 people out there who think what we're doing is right, enough so that they're willing to put $10 a month in the kitty to make it happen. And that kind of mandate from individuals, I think, is what Karen's getting at with, we're a public charity, get the public to support us.
Yeah, right. That is super, super cool. But I mean, you still have a number, you still want to hit a certain dollar amount so you can pay the bills. So even if you're not publicizing it, there's a number somewhere in a spreadsheet where if we don't hit this, we're in trouble. I mean, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're gonna be evaluating that as the campaign. I mean, so we're right at the moment we're recording that. I don't know how long your release schedule is. We're recording this right at the end of February. The beginning of March starts our new fiscal year. We're gonna have a board of directors meeting that'll set our budget for our fiscal 2016 year, which starts March 1st for us. And we'll make a decision about how far we've gotten and what we're able to continue to do. And we're expecting to pre-announce, because Karen will be just thrilled that I'm pre-announcing something. We're expecting to really have a dialogue with the public and say, this is how far we got. This is where we still want to get to. This is what we're going to do in the meantime. We want to have that kind of conversation. I hope Karen's not mad at me now pre-announcing things.
No, I'm not mad. I was actually going to say that I was really surprised that a good number of individuals gave more than the number we asked for, which was incredibly meaningful and cool. Also sort of, you know, helps to figure in. Yeah, the larger individual donations are so much more meaningful, provided that people continue to commit to giving them in the future, which is not always guaranteed. But you know, when supporters give more, it gives us a chance to kind of think about, well, can we look more at the overall number rather than the number of people?
Yeah, and that's why we set the dues. Oh, sorry to interrupt, Karen. I was going to say that's why we set the dues at 120, specifically because it divides out to $10 a month. And I think a lot about how if you're in the industrialized world, you know, if you're in a European or a U.S. or in the U.S., you probably can and you have a good paying job in software development. $10 a month is probably somewhere around a go out to eat one night kind of budget. And so if you go out to eat one less time per month, you can afford to do that and, you know, cook at home that night.
I don't know where you think that our listeners eat, but go out to eat for $10? Is there Taco Bell every day?
I work for a charity, man. I mean, getting to go the California Pizza Kitchen and getting one of those little pizzas, like that's going out to eat to me. I guess we all have to go to fancy restaurants. I get that once a year, man.
And
that Bradley, you made the point that in a blog post, actually, that for $20 a month, you can support a conservancy and FSF. And $20 is, you know, probably more the kind of meal you were expecting, Jono.
Yeah, that's great and everything, like, guys. But just to wrap this up, because we're running a little bit long, I would just like to give you guys the suggestion that perhaps you should have a little checkbox where you add an additional $5 so that Bradley can go to Taco Bell an additional time per month on the donation page. I think that would probably go over well.
You can add that checkbox.
As I say, I think we all have a ton more questions, but we are now way over time.
You can add that checkbox at sfconservancy.org/supporter. People, go and check that out. I'm a conservancy supporter. I think they do really important work, and I think we'd all agree that our listeners should go and check that out as well. Thank you, Bradley and Karen, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks for giving us much time. Much appreciated.
Okay, now on the show for a quick update is Rachel Romeliotis, who is a strategic content director at O'Reilly for OSCON. So how are you doing, Rachel?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, great. Well, in the previous show, we talked about conferences. We're specifically talking about Scale, and we're specifically talking about LCA, which is in Australia, and we're talking about how these are great community-centric conferences. And OSCON popped up into conversation, and you very generously offered to come on and have a quick chat about OSCON. So one of the things that we touched on was that there are some conferences that have a very community feel about them, such as Scale. And then there are some conferences which feel a little bit more like they're serving the industry, such as OSCON. And the assertion from some people is that OSCON is a bit more kind of like industry orientated. What's your take on that?
Well, I like to think that OSCON is a reflection of the open source community at large. And that community is getting very, very big and very, very diverse with, you know, new people using open source all the time, new contributors, and teams, not just people, getting into the action. So I like to think we're reflective of all of that, and we've been around for the journey, and we're certainly different than we were 20 years ago, 5 years ago. So hopefully we're different every year.
And speaking of being different, this year it feels like there is a freshening going on, if you will. Like some people who usually go to OSCON, it seems like there's a, you know, looking at the schedule, it seems like a brand new set of names in there, like new people and new blood, which we touched on in the previous show, which we think is pretty good, like it, to keep conferences fresh and that you don't just have this click that's happening. Sure. Is there a conscious focus this year? I know it's in Austin, it's a different location this year. Is there an explicit focus to make this kind of fresher and newer, or is something else going on?
So I think that what I wanted to be explicit was to make sure that more people in OSCON, and so because of that, we had more proposals than we've ever had before. But as usual, we get to pick 10% of those, or I guess that percentage is getting smaller and smaller. So yeah, there's probably half the people are new, and I think half have spoken at one time or another. And people who, you know, you don't see this year, you'll definitely see next year. And I'm actually reaching out to individuals to help in different ways. Like, you know, Simon Wardley is going to be a keynote speaker. I don't know if that's officially announced. Right. So you heard that here. But but yeah, there's other people that are working with us in different ways. And I hope that everyone can rally around the new people and bring them into the community. So.
Cool. Yeah. My wife is actually going to be a keynote speaker.
Oh,
as well.
I know. Erica, you know, what's so funny? I didn't know she was your wife. So I was like, what?
Yeah.
I don't think she's quite come to terms with it yet either.
she's patient and partially blind. So you know, how in that theme of, you know, we talked about scale and LCA being very community centric, and it feels like it resonates very strongly with community members in the Linux and the open source community. One of the reasons why I think a lot of people go there who are more community orientated is because it's a lot cheaper. Like OSCON is a relatively expensive event to go to.
Word.
You know, how do you bridge that gap? How do you help to kind of, you said earlier on about representing like the open source community, a significant part of the open source community. I mean, we've talked in another interview about, you know, how if you work for a charity, you don't have a lot of money, disposable income. How do you bridge that gap where you can deliver a conference that represents the open source community, yet it's still affordable for people to go to, yet and O'Reilly still to make a profit?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting place to be because, like you said, we are a business and we want to help the community. And, you know, we do have a significant ticket price, but I think it's worth it because what you get out of it, I think hopefully you'll make up either in promotions or new jobs or what have you. But we do a lot for the community as well. We do have scholarships that people can apply for, and we're hoping to have more and more of those. We have different types of tickets where you can go just to sessions or you can go to training courses. And, you know, and we support basically the, you know, having different foundations that are nonprofit, you know, there as well. So I hear what you're saying. You know, we found that a lot of our community that has been in the past, and it's been for a few years, is enterprise-focused. So I think that we're seeing that people are getting those tickets taken care of, but that doesn't help, you know, the individual.
Right.
So I hear that. I guess what I'm hoping is that it's worth it. I mean, that's what we're really aiming for. We're really trying to, starting with this year, we're trying to make some changes, and we're trying to update and keep up to date and be reflective of what people need so that you're not only going there. I mean, of course, the hallway track is amazing, right? You get to talk to, like, Larry Wall and stuff. But you're going there. You're actually going to come back. You're going to come back and, you know, have something that you, where you can do your job better. So hopefully you'll get that money back.
Right.
So along those lines, with so many enterprise open sourcey conferences like the OpenStack summits and the SUSE cons and Red Hat summits and all and LinuxCon and all these other summits that are so enterprise focused, how does OSCON stand out? How does OSCON differentiate itself from the 7,500 other enterprise focused open sourcey conferences?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And so, so I guess I'd go back to the sort of reflection of, I guess, the fact that we want open source to grow and we don't necessarily have a foundation, right?
Wait. Is what you're saying is that the OpenStack Foundation wants open source to shrink? Is that the insinuation? Just to be clear on this.
I'm not sure that's what Rachel's saying.
I'm trying to pull something inflammatory out of this here.
Just ignore him, Rachel. He's an idiot.
I'm with you. You're okay.
Okay. No, basically, so one of the tracks that we have is Open Source 101, where we are realizing that, you know, we've gotten to this point. We want to continue to have some of the tenants that created, you know, and a thriving open source community. We want those to live on. We also want to take in sort of new ideas. And so we have an open source 101 track. And so that's really aimed at people who are users, but that want to get more involved. So hopefully we'll be converting a bunch of people to contributors. So I think that's different than what you've seen elsewhere. We're also in the midst of creating sort of an open source hackathon, which I can't speak to too much yet. We're still kind of in the idea phase, but that will be at this cool. year's event as well. So I think what we're trying to show is, back to the original point about the OpenStack thing is, you know, we're not just OpenStack. We're everything. Obviously it would be impossible to have everything at the conference, but we're really trying to show a lot of all the different types. And it is a fact that enterprise-driven open source is a reality today. And so, one, we have to, like, kind of say, like, okay, this exists. And two, you know, maybe we have a chance to say, like, hey, maybe you should do it this way, or what are you doing that for? Or maybe something that they are doing is good, you know? So.
And it's always tough as well, because when you do anything for a long period of time, I mean, OSCON's been around for years. It can become kind of like the standard, and it can become the thing that people just are used to going to. So it becomes a little bit less exciting because it's like a staple. And trying to innovate within that while also, you know, keeping your existing people happy, I can understand, puts the OSCON team in a pretty tough spot at times, because we see that in other areas as well. But thank you, Rachel, for coming on and answering our mostly intelligent questions, with the exception of
you're welcome, you know,
that guy. And let us also not forget that the Community Leadership Summit is the weekend before OSCON in the same venue. So, all right. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Yeah, let us not forget that. nice plug, dude.
So that was the show, The Blue Stupid Suitcase, or whatever it's called, which is very, very, very stupid indeed. KDE Neon, which is also potentially very, very stupid indeed.
I'm looking forward to what you're going to say about the Software Freedom Conservancy.
The Software Freedom Conservancy is apparently a very good idea. Well done. All right.
A lot of vitriol on this outro.
Yeah. You know, and Brian's not even here.
No, I know. But that, to me, fascinating, the SFC thing, because they're kind of, yeah, well, we're seeing it's not very clear whether GPL is dropping off and permissive licenses are on the rise or whatever. And I'm sitting there thinking, really? Wow, doesn't that all happen from where I'm sitting?
No, but maybe it's
completely different, you know?
Well, I do agree with him that it's very difficult to measure, but by most measurements, it seems.
It seems like, you know, there's definitely people writing, you know, GPL software. There's no doubt that that's happening, but I think one of the metrics here is what are like open source businesses using, and by and large they're moving to the APL, like from what I can see. So
yeah,
and MIT and have been for a long time, you know, because it's just difficult to have a business model with a GPL. I mean, it's doable, but it's difficult.
And honestly, the worst thing about that is, once you get to a certain point, you've hit a tipping point where there's an APL and MIT, whatever, a permissive version of everything that exists. The whole GNU project vibe has always been, well, we'll have the best software, but it's GPL. And then people have the choice of using the GPL, and then they have to be GPL as well. Or they have to go to all the effort of writing their own proprietary version. Hence GCC or whatever. But that only applies as long as GCC is streets ahead of all the competition, and it isn't now. You can just go, I'll just use LLVM, whatever, you know.
It's the one thing I was going to ask them, and I like to ask people this in various places, is, and this I think particularly applies
Will
to
you
the,
buy me a cocktail?
Well, that as well. It particularly applies to the Conservancy people. Like, Bradley touched on this, but what they do is freaking thankless work a lot of the time.
It really is.
They really are. I mean, they are taking care of the day-to-day details of, you know, making sure that free software can operate. And one of the things I wanted to ask them was, like, why do they do it? Like, there is work that is very principled and very important, which is, I think, one of the reasons why they do it. But then you, at some point, balance, like, what's principled and important work with, you know, enjoying your life. And they their level of devotion and commitment to what they do, I think, is incredible. And I just don't get definitely. Why they do it. And I don't get why other people do this.
I think it's amazing.
Well.
They're like the, you know, the lib paper sizes guy from a development perspective. But all the work they do about, having to help you sort out insurance for your project and license enforcement and drawing up a foundation, all this kind of thing. You spend your whole life working in the shadows and then you die in obscurity and no one knows how important all the stuff you did was. I don't know how people manage it. It drives me nuts. Having an ego the size of All Outdoors doesn't help here. Well, here's the thing, right? So to prove that point, without looking them up, and Jeremy, you've probably looked this up, name the board of the SFC.
I thought it was just Tony.
They don't have a board. That's one of the contentions. That's one of the contentions with the whole Linux Foundation thing is I don't believe they have a board.
They absolutely, first of all, they don't.
The only three people
board.
I know there are Karen, Tony, and Bradley.
No, you see, but there's a bunch of other people, and you've heard of these people. Martin Michelmeyer's on the board.
Oh,
Jeremy Allison's on the board. But you've got no idea that this is the case, and you're a supporter of the damn SFC. This is what
I'm
talking
support
about.
Them. I don't actually, you know, pay attention to everything that they do. I mean, I just want them to keep the lights on. I like some of my money.
Conservancy's directors are... No, I'm just looking it up now.
Oh, there are the directors. Jeremy Allison.
The list of directors, Jeremy Allison, Mark Galassi, Brad Kuhn, Mike Linksfire, who was at Creative Commons, Martin Michelmeyer, and Stormy Peters.
I didn't know that there was a board. One thing that I think we should do, I had this idea earlier on.
And like, they do really important work, and no one knows.
It appeared from one of the most revealing things in that interview is that Bradley Kuhn needs a decent meal. $10 to eat. I mean, come on. So I think we should set up a competing fund to raise money. And it's basically the Brad Kuhn Taco Bell.
The software fund. Taco Conservancy.
It would be comedy gold if we ended up raising more money, but that's almost certainly not going to happen. Maybe that's another business model.
It would also be downright mean, Regina George. You're not supposed to do this kind of thing.
How is it mean? It's raising money for the Software Freedom Laws people.
Oh, if it actually raises money for them, then fine. I assumed you were going to take the money and then just buy one massive taco with it, with SFC written on the side of it or something. No.
We'll buy that pizza that we had when you came over here.
Yes, we will. 23-inch pizza.
Largest pizza I've ever seen.
It was excellent.
Anyway, this is in no way relevant or interesting to our listeners.
I can only imagine that 80% of them stopped listening 90 seconds ago, so that's probably good. Right. Anyway.
Potentially 90 minutes ago.
I think that ship sailed a long time ago, if I'm honest. But
anything we need to... any final things we need to say or any final insults to Brian behind his back while he's not here?
I find they're more fun when he's here, yeah.
Oh, he's all right. I think he's overrated. He's a twonkle.
No, we love Brian. We don't think he's a twonkle, whatever that is.
Whatever that is. Cool.
Although, I guess we'll end it on this. We have found the one thing that I will not eat, a boiled Brian head.
I would definitely not touch that. All right, well, thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening. Go to community.badvoltage.org and join in the conversation, and we'll see you on the next show.
I am the Lord of the Fates, and he and I need you.
Here we go. One, two,
three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
Gonna line up perfect.
even by our spectacular standards, that was poor quality counting.
4 2-year-olds would have synced up better than
you
that.
You want to do it again?
1, 2,
3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.